one thing I want to say about language is that throughout the talk, I might forget to sometimes insert the word racist with regard to the alt-right or the far-right or populist or whatnot, but I actually think it's imperative that we explicitly use the word racist because the white nationalist movement, Trump himself, always deny that they're being racist, right? It's about cultural heritage. It's about identity. But we know better than that, okay? I'm going to dive right into it. You know, like a good immigrant, I don't like wasting time or money. So I was overambitious with this talk, and I wanted to address two major topics. This is the story of my masochistic life. The first research question of the two acts is, when sociology centers the citizenship line, what do we learn about the resistance of people of color who suffer citizenship-based racism? And I'm drawing on my current book manuscript, which, inspired by my colleague, I'm also thinking of naming Killing Us Softly, so maybe you can help me in the Q&A. And it focuses on Asian American Pacific Islander immigrant activists and Latinx activists in L.A., okay. The second question, the second act is, does the citizenship line help us answer this burning question, which is, what underpinned and signaled the shift to a U.S. discourse and movement rooted in overt nativist racism or white nationalism, albeit as anti-black racism ensues? Okay, so that's an important parenthetical phrase that I'll elaborate on later. Okay. So, I'm going to start with some background, and some of this is going to be familiar. As I said, I'm, you know, conscious of time, so I want to give some background on anti-Latinx racism, and specifically I'm focusing on Mexican, Central American, nativist racism. And, you know, one of the arcs that I think we can identify is that, you know, historically, Mexican ethnics, you know, were socioculturally seen as not American or forever racialized as foreigner. Since 1924 and the Bracero program in 1965, as Mae Nye writes in her book, they've really become racialized in a nativist way on the basis of being illegal aliens, so de facto non-white in this sense, okay? Of course, throughout this time, they've been racialized as white formally, but we see how race is very right? You know, one of the things I want to emphasize here is the Trump tropes, which we'll elaborate on a little bit later. You know, we've always heard, okay, these Latinos, they drain our resources, they steal our jobs. You know, this is all familiar, unfortunately, to us. But the Trump trope that he often emphasizes is the criminality of these Mexican and Central American immigrants, right? The raping, the drug trafficking, being MS-13 gangbangers, the invasion by the migrant caravan, okay? And so you see this in his eloquent Twitter post right here. Okay. Now, the background of nativist racism against Asian Americans, I think within sociology, is less familiar. I can't go over all of it for lack of time, but I will just provide some of the major kind of discursive tropes along which nativist racism has happened. And the arc that you kind of see here in the Asian American case is that the nativist racism was premised more on legal tenets, right? Like, you know, the Exclusion Act starting in 1875, and that culminated in the 1924 Johnson-Reed Act. And then, you know, thereafter, the way Asian Americans have been racialized as foreigners, forever foreigners, has been more sociocultural. Now, this is a crude kind of rendering, but, you know, I'm trying to give sort of a general picture. Okay, so one of the first tropes that is more commonly deployed is that of the foreign economic threat, politically expendable. The other is colonial imperial outsider, wartime enemy, spy. You know, Asian Americans don't represent us Americans. Wealthy invaders, especially in this era of transnational global capitalism. Academic threat. Many of us don't know that anti-Asian American violence rates are quite high and have been high since the 1990s, and refugee threat, okay? So I've highlighted some of the ones that I think are, you know, quite interesting. I want to just point out the case of Vincent Chin, with which some of you may be familiar already. But in the 1980s, when the U.S. auto industry was busy Japan bashing because they were experiencing quite a bit of competition from Japan's auto industry, you know, they were laying off workers. And in Detroit, two laid off white American GM workers decided that people that looked like Vincent Chin, who is not even Japanese American, he's Chinese American, were to blame. You know, outside of a Detroit McDonald's, they pinned him and they swung a baseball bat at his head as if they were trying to hit a home run. He died. This is Mother Lily Chin, who was so distraught by what she considered a racist justice system that she actually immigrated back to China after living in the United States for a long time. The case was so important because the two white American killers were actually exonerated by a white American judge who said this was an aberration. You know, they're good, upstanding citizens otherwise. And so this sparked a major Asian American movement in the United States. And I think it's a good example because it brings in lots of stuff, right? Economics, restructuring, the racial lumping of people of color, the justice system, etc. You know, a case with which many of you are familiar is that, you know, especially since 9/11, but even before, South Asian Americans, Asian Muslim Americans, have been caught up in the surveillance, the detentions, the lack of due process of law. You know, some of you may be familiar that the Trump administration has, in an unprecedented move, redesignated Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees and have begun major deportations. Okay. Okay, so to kind of flesh out my original research question about this issue of the citizenship line and the color line, I think looking at political scientist Claire Jean Kim's theory is very helpful. It's called racial triangulation. I actually think this model is quite brilliant. I think it's underappreciated and underused in sociology. You know, we're not empirically testing it so much. But here you see that in, you know, her kind of Bourdieuian field of racial positions, Kim is addressing both a color line, which she denotes with this vertical axis here of superior inferior, and the one that we've most associated with white over black dynamics. And then she also has what I like to call a citizenship line, which is this horizontal axis, right, of being racialized as outsiders, un-American foreigners, right, and being positioned as insiders. So essentially what she's arguing is that there are at least two social processes that position these three groups vis-a-vis one another, okay? So relative valorization is the dotted line. Whites are relatively valorizing Asian Americans, sorry, this isn't perfectly in the middle, you know, above black Americans, right? And therefore they're positioned in the middle of this color line, right? But she also talks about a solid line social process of civic ostracism premised on some of those nativist racist, you know, tropes and practices that I just showed you, where they're civically ostracized as forever foreigners. Okay. So I want us to kind of think about, you know, the issues that I raise, you know, from this framing. But what I'm also going to be doing is kind of expanding on this and extending it. Okay. The other body of literature with which I engage is the citizenship literature. And I'm especially inspired by political theorist Iris Marion Young, sociologist Evelyn Nakano Glenn, and others that I'll name. So one of the first frameworks that I think is quite helpful is that of Renato Rosaldo, called cultural citizenship. It's a critical ethno-racial framework in the sense that Rosaldo is saying that cultural citizenship is the margins forging a cultural recognition that they're denied, okay? Usually it's racialized, ethnicized cultural recognition. And so therefore, it's necessarily a form of resistance, right? The other group of scholars that have written extensively on citizenship are critical feminists, okay? You know, one of the contributions that critical feminists have made is to not kind of think about citizenship, you know, just as this kind of legal status or as this abstract kind of principle, but to really think of citizenship as a practice and an embodied practice, right? And so this is particularly important for groups such as women, people of color, who experience subordination by dominant society because they're seen as much more in their bodies, right? They're less rational, impartial, right? In terms of, they're less mental, right? But they're really in their bodies, okay? So they're athletic or they give birth to babies, whatnot. Okay, and then another dimension of this literature is care work, right? That scholars like Hurd and Harrington Meyer argue that what women do in terms of care work in society is actually a civic responsibility, and it provides civic benefits to society. Okay, so this is linked up with notions of maternal citizenship, such as by Kim Leake and Norman, this view that mothers have certain political, social rights that they're exercising from that standpoint of motherhood. Okay, Yuval Davis talks about citizenship as a participatory, process, but she also says there's the dimension of belonging, right? And she says that that belonging is necessarily emotional and emotive, and I'm going to really be extending from that, okay? Arlie Hochschild from the beginning, scholars like Sarah Ahmed have shown us that emotional life is always tied to power in one way, shape, or form. Okay, and I think this is salient given that we're talking a lot about emotions in sociology now. Okay, so for Act One, what is my ad? Well, my ad is that I think what's often going on in the case of immigrants, in particular like the AAPI and Latinx immigrants I studied, is that embodied citizenship is what they prioritize and what they, practice, enact, right? And I define it as resistance and belonging by way of gendered caring for bodies and emotions of those hurt by nativist racism and related injustices. So as you can see here, I'm bringing in various dimensions of the literature. I want to stress that it's caring for other people's bodies and other people's emotions, because I actually see emotionality as a part of embodiment. Sometimes you guys see this separated, but I'm not defining it in quite a discreet manner. Okay, so my data and method, what did I do? During this period, interrupted by the birth of my first child, which is why there's a pause there, I did about 3.5 years or close to 300 hours of ethnographic participant observation in movements in Los Angeles. Primarily, I focused on environmental justice, because these movements were located in the port industrial belt of LA. This is right next to the Port of Los Angeles in Long Beach, which is the biggest port in the country, the fifth largest in the world. And through there come cargo container ships. There are, next to it are rail yards. And then, of course, there are freeways that use diesel to bring stuff to all the stores from which we shop. Okay, and they go all over the country, right? But precisely because of this goods movement, these AAPI and Latinx activists and their children suffer disproportionately from asthma, okay, cancer, bronchitis, and fibromyalgia, and all kinds of other ailments, okay? The other movement in which I took part, because they were also, sort of wearing multiple movement hats, was immigration rights and reform, but also school reform. Okay, so those are kind of the top three movements they were involved with. I also did close to 50 interviews with activist leaders, members, and detached allies of 5 community-based organizations and 3 supplementary organizations. So what I want to tell you about these groups is that because they're focused generally on their surrounding environment, they tended to be mostly Mexican, right, working class, mostly unauthorized, immigrant, okay? And then there's, another organization that was mostly rooted in Carson, where there are a lot of Filipinx Americans, so that was a predominantly Filipinx and AAPI organization. And then 2 of them were more mixed, right? You have AAPIs, Latinx, Black Americans, etc., okay? And then the third major method I used was documents analysis. So I just, this was the less exciting part of the project, but I analyzed hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents, okay? Quickly, I will say, just for comparison's sake, the Asian American activists, like the Philippine Ex-American Group, People's Corps, tended to be lower middle class or middle class. They tended to be citizens. So there are differences and similarities between the organizations, okay? All right, so starting with my data, as part of my question for Act One, one thing that initially surprised me as I was doing the research was, you know, as someone who's organized in the past, you know, I expected to talk a lot about, you know, the minutiae and the vagaries of politics and organizing, but one of the things that the activists wanted to talk to me a lot about was their emotional state. Okay, and they wanted to talk about kind of the emotional consequences of, you know, suffering nativist racism and, you know, all the kinds of ups and downs of organizing, for those of you who know about that, right? And so because of time, I can only give you snapshots, but these are snapshots that I think are emblematic of what other people were largely echoing, okay? So this comes from Carmen. She's a leader of Community Partners Council, and she says, I was thinking that one of the things that made you want to go to CPC was the sorrow that you were in a country that wasn't yours, okay? So, you know, this is a common refrain, you know, just one of the consequences of nativist racism is sorrow, okay? Now, to speak more directly to the ways that they were redefining and sort of practicing in a different way citizenship, I found really instructive what the unauthorized immigrants had to say, okay? So, one of the questions that I asked the unauthorized immigrants was, if you become a citizen, will you be interested in voting or focusing more on getting Latinos elected? Okay, and I get it. This is, you know, a question that's projecting into the future, but clearly something that they thought a lot about, and they're engaged in the political realm. You know, they deal with the formal electoral realm, right? And what's interesting is that the answers, you know, constellated around this theme of really being invested in what they consider their small p politics. I mean, I'm putting that name on it, but it really seemed resonant of a small p politics conceptualization. And why? Because they really emphasized that embodied emotional support that they got from that kind of organizing. So let me give you an example here from Celia. She says, I stay there with CPC because that's where I started. They, CPC, also help us know where there are resources and how to look for them, because a lot of people are afraid because they don't have papers. They, CPC, do not ask, and thanks to CPC, I haven't had those fears. It's an obstacle I've overcome. So interestingly, I asked her a question, you know, if you become a citizen, will you vote? You know, are you going to focus on getting Latinos elected? And, you know, her first response is, I'm just going to stay with this, you know, community-based, small-p politics, because, you know, they provide resources, they don't ask about papers, they don't obsess over things like that. They've helped me overcome the emotional obstacles of fear. Okay. I asked a similar question to an unauthorized Filipina youth immigrant named Lily. And I asked, if you become a citizen, will you be interested in voting? And she responds, well, sort of, and she pauses. I mean, I really don't keep up. And you can tell she's embarrassed, as if she should be keeping up and should want to say yes. And I said, why is that? And she said, because it's not like those big politicians come over to our neighborhood, have coffee with us, and ask us how we're doing, what our problems are. They don't do our people politics. They've only let us in this country until they don't need us anymore. Then they're like ready to kick us out. It's like someone you put all your effort into being friends with, and then when they don't need you anymore, they just drop you. By the way, I love how millennials think, right? Like, I never would have responded this way. It's so interesting. So I'm asking her, you know, if and when you become a citizen, right, voting, which is the formal, you know, rendering of citizenship that we usually engage. And her answer is, well, I don't really keep up, and here's why. They don't do the emotional labor of coming to us, asking how we're doing, asking what our problems are, and helping us try to solve them, the people politics that we do, right? And in fact, as unauthorized immigrants, you know, we're used to this notion that they're simply just kind of exploiting us and using us, and then we don't need you anymore, just like those friends who drop you, they emotionally abandon you, okay? Another way in which you notice this redefinition of citizenship as embodied in emotional support comes in the response to the question that elites and outsiders would often ask them, which is, well, okay, so you guys are all getting sick and cancer from, you know, the air quality problems. Why don't you move? Okay, why don't you move somewhere cleaner? Clearly, there's classist, you know, assumptions in that question, and people brought that up. But, you know, this was a response that came from an AAPI Samoan immigrant named Cindy, and she says, for each of us, we're all called to do something in our lives, in our communities. And for me, this is, I feel, part of what I've been called to do. Even if it costs my health, I need to fight for these children. We have the people always tell us, you can transfer, go to another school. But who is going to fight for these children, for this community? Who is going to fight for my family? So leaving is not an option. Okay, so this was interesting, you know, instead of focusing on the class dimension of it or just the really presumptuous sort of patronizing element of it, you know, she basically says, look, you know, even if it kills me softly, right, even if it affects my health, and she had a lot of chronic health problems from the pollution, you know, she says, if I don't stay here, nobody's going to defend, you know, my community, and actually nobody's going to defend me. Right? So there's this reciprocity of emotional support that's highly important. Okay? Some people were much more terse, but otherwise still profound, right? So Tanya, a Mexican immigrant, you know, when I asked her the same question, she just responded, I'd be leaving them all alone, you know, and indignant, and she was shaking her head and huffing, right? So the theoretical implications of embodied citizenship, as I conceptualize it, is that, you know, when immigrants in particular are disadvantaged intersectionally, I think we really have to think about the ways in which they are intersectionally, you know, trying to forge their own sense of citizenship and belonging, okay? So it incorporates racial and cultural recognition, such as from Renato Rosaldo's cultural citizenship. They do feel invisible, politically expendable. It's also always a care-based practice, but I want to stress that it's not always maternal, okay? These women are mothers, the women I'm pictured with here. But, you know, sometimes they were actually sacrificing their maternal duties to be good community activists, right? It's not always maternally animated. It's not also just about our own belonging or my own belonging, that embodied citizenship is about ensuring others' people's belonging. So unlike scholars previously who kind of separate out the participation and the belonging dimensions of citizenship, I think these activists show that they're always fused, interrelated. The next point is that it's not just about the positive emotions of belonging, as scholars have said, but I think it's the positive emotions associated with giving emotional support to others, you know, as we heard from the narratives, okay? This embodied citizenship is always political. Okay, as I said, you know, we can conceptualize it like small p politics. You know, this flies in the face of scholarship that has said that, you know, these women who are starting to be at the forefront of a lot of these immigrant movements, right, they often don't see what they're doing as political because they see it as an extension of their mothering duties. And that's not at all the case with these activists. They say what we're doing is thoroughly political, okay? For the unauthorized in particular, their relationship to the state, or what we can call big P, the institutional realm, is not emotionally positive. In fact, they feel emotionally assaulted by the state. They feel exploited. And so I think that lends itself to a weak kind of assimilation impulse here about going into the formal electoral realm. Now, make no mistake, I'm not saying that if and when they become citizens, they're not going to go vote. They will, okay? I'm not saying that they're not going to try, you know, to make sure that they have representatives that, you know, especially the ones they think are going to really, you know, advocate for their issues. But what I'm saying is that that's not where they identify themselves. That's not where they're going to invest the bulk of their lives because they don't have any kind of embodied and emotional attachment to that realm, okay? All right, so I want to go on to Act 2 and focus here on the select nativist racisms that signaled the Trump era, okay? Now, I know I have the word prediction a lot, and I just want to clarify that I'm not just concerned with prediction for prediction's sake, okay? I'm concerned about prediction because it is powerful, right? It's powerful for our deeper knowledge of society, and therefore the implications that, this deeper predictive knowledge has for social injustices, right? As sociologists, as social scientists, what processes do we choose to study and from what lenses? Okay. By the way, these are pictures of people reacting to Trump's win. Maybe you identify with some of them. I'm definitely her right there. I suspected that he would win, but it was still, it was devastating. Okay. So when I kind of saw this era of racist nativism, white nationalism unfold, I couldn't stop thinking about James McKee's work, Sociology and the Race Problem, the Failure of a Perspective. Okay. Even in 1963, President Hughes said sociology's inability to foresee the 1960s black protest era was the failure of the sociological imagination. Okay. I can't address all of McKee's arguments, but one of the signal arguments of the book is that by the 1950s, sociology, if you look at our intellectual historiography, they had adopted this new conservative view on the modernization of the United States, right? And that this modernization was signaling that non-whites, the ones that we thought we could, never assimilate, will assimilate. The process will be inevitable. It'll be gradual. They didn't predict it would be violent, and that it would come by the dint of white rather than black initiative. Okay? Wrong on all fronts. Okay? So I can't help but wonder if there's a McKee moment today, right? One of the conclusions of McKee is that he thinks the sociology of race in particular should have been more focused and should be focusing more on pluralism and not just on assimilation, right? But what sociology has generally done been to focus on the assimilation framework, especially along the color line. And so if we think about kind of the white over black color line, it is one on which Asian Americans, Latinx, Middle Eastern Americans, etc., have been assimilating as non-blacks. Now, this is not to argue that there are not assimilatory processes. Of course there are, right? But what it is to say is that sometimes maybe we were too singular in our outlook and it didn't quite help us understand the groundswell, right? One of the main questions I think this begs is, where is the citizenship order in this non-black, black order? Okay. One of the ways that we could reconceptualize it is, how might the citizenship line and the color line be concurrent, right? Or maybe even co-constitutive. Okay. Are they interrelating? Are they helping shape one another? And I think this does better answer the question about what underpinned and signaled this shift we have now to this overt, racism used to be more coded, and it's premised on white nationalism or racist white nationalism, right? Of course, all of this is happening within what Patricia Hill Collins, A Matrix of Domination. I'm going to go over this relatively quickly. I assume some of you know this already. Clearly, neoliberalism from Reagan to Obama and continued under Trump has hurt everybody that's not wealthy or close to wealthy, right? The decline of unions, skyrocketing costs of college, skyrocketing costs of health, okay? The threats to Social Security, Medicare, the underfunding of K-12. I could go on and on and on. Okay, so clearly, these processes matter. Okay, and I will speak in a minute about how we could think more about the interrelationship between economics and race as well. One of the other major processes that has been going on is demographic change and major shifts in political power. When I write they're coming, I'm referring to the fact that it's the areas in England and the areas in the United States where you saw the fastest pace of immigrant growth. It wasn't the number of immigrants per se. It was the fastest pace of immigrant growth that predicted the strongest support for Brexit and the strongest support for Trump. Okay. And it's also places where there was weak contact. Okay. So weak contact between the native born American community and, the immigrants that were coming in. Okay. So this supports the contact hypothesis, right? Those areas most strongly predicted Brexit support and Trump support. I think we undervalue this, historical moment, but Zepeda Mian in his great book shows us that the immigration protests of 2006 that had millions of people in the street, that he calls the largest civil, rights protest movement in American history, there was a lot of backlash after that. Okay. And of course, the political change is also, marked with BLM, with Me Too, etc. Okay. Now, as many of you well know, politicians have long scapegoated immigrants for economic downturns. There's nothing new about that, right? But I think one of the points that we have to bear in mind is that it is the whites that were lower status, but not the worst off. Okay. Who felt the most acute sense of relative deprivation vis-a-vis people of color and immigrants. Okay? So whites with lower incomes were not as supportive of Trump and the Republican Party platform. So one of the things that I'm doing in a research project I'm excited about with David Brady from UC Riverside, some of you may know his work, he focuses on poverty and inequality. You know, we're really trying to look and see if it's the non-college educated whites, right, that, you know, were compelled to, vote for Trump, et cetera. You know, you can be working class and still make a decent income. And in fact, the data from a lot of these studies seems to point that out. Okay. Okay. Now, I just want to quickly say that we have to remember, and so as not to be so partisan. I mean, you know, the neoliberal state got an assist from Obama, right? The deporter in chief. This number, 1.7 million, would eventually rise to over 3 million deported. Okay. The largest in American history by any U.S. president. And most of them were not criminal because we just don't have enough undocumented immigrants committing crimes. Okay. Neoliberal economics, I want to go through this relatively quickly, but, if we go back to David Brady's and my kind of research question, look at here an advanced degree premium. If you have that, you earn 220% of a high school graduate's hourly wages, okay? If you move to the right, look here. This is a share of the income quintile that has a four-year degree. Compare 1979 to 2016, right? Look how many more people in 2016 from the top and upper middle class, has to have a college degree. Okay, so I want to now stress the four processes of nativist racism that I think we should have had our lenses more squarely on and should have been interrelating with each other. And I'm sure there are others, but these are the ones that I've identified. Okay. The first one is the existence of European far-right populism long before Trump and what I consider Trump's mimicry of it. And this is also part of Brady's and my research project. The second major process of nativist racism is the popularization of the majority-minority America sociological statistic and the reaction to that, okay? So what happens when our data go mainstream, right? It's great to see us in the news, but sad the reaction. The third major nativist racism process is the rise of the Tea Party and Tea Party racism. And I'm going to use Obama as a snapshot, okay? And then the fourth process of nativist racism is the rise of hate groups and hate crimes, especially post 9/11, which is something right in New York's backyard. Okay. All right. So let's talk about the European far right and Trump mimicry. Now, one of the first things that I want to emphasize is that I do think if sociology was more ensconced in the lens of empire, in post-colonialism, in settler colonialism, I do think that we would have actually paid more attention to this, because one of the things that you recognize is that how do empires sustain themselves, right? Well, sometimes one of the best ways they do that is by mimicking other empires, okay? And I think that's especially true in a time of decline, right? sometimes I feel a lot of cognitive dissonance as a scholar, because I'll go to American studies or Asian American studies, and all we're framing everything through is empire. And then I'll go to sociology and I feel like, you know, it's just not defining our field, right? And it's just like, I'm homeless academically, you know? But anyways, so these are the names of the leaders and the parties that had come to political prominence before Trump, okay? And this last one is kind of just addressing the rise of neo-Nazi movements in Europe since the 1980s. It should be no surprise to any of us that Trump's first foreign party leader visitor was Nigel Farage, okay, the ringleader of Brexit. Okay, and this is Geert Wilders pictured here of the Netherlands. He's somebody who's crudely and grossly anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim. Okay, one of the ways that the Trump mimicry idea sort of sparked in me was by reading Brubaker, who I don't think ever addresses race enough, but one of the things he says is similar between European racist populism and Trumpian racist populism, and what I consider a mimicry, is the fact that they talk in terms of this vertical axis of the elite above the people, right? And what's most important is that people like, you know, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy and Trump, you know, they are part of the elite, right? They're billionaires, millionaires, whatever. We don't know how much money Trump has. But, you know, the thing is that they always claim that I'm part of you guys, the people. Okay, that's why, you know, these European leaders, Trump, will say, you know, you are the forgotten Americans, right? Trump will say at his rallies at the Republican convention, I am your voice. Okay. So emperor's new clothes, right? The other axis that gets overlapped by both, you know, these European leaders and Trump is the notion of who's inside and who's outside. So this really reminds me of Claire Jean Kim's racial triangulation. But the idea is that the people are the insiders and the elites are the outsiders, right? Why are they outsiders? Because they're out of touch, right? They don't care about you guys. They're obsessed with political correctness and they're always trying to shut you up or silence you, right? They're well to do, etc. Okay. One of the other things that I thought of was in reading Cynthia Miller Idris's book about the European racist far right. She argues that fashion, right, has become central to the recruitment and the shoring up of the far right in Europe, especially among youth, okay? You know, clothes, symbols, wording, right, have become a major part of this. And, you know, yeah, Trump wanted to make a quick buck off those hats, but I also think it's fascinating, and I think it could very well signal taking a page out of their playbook, right? To have hats, right, with a slogan, brightly colored. I mean, how many presidential candidates have done that before? Okay. And clearly he's influenced by Bannon. You know, maybe he was indirectly influenced by, you know, Stephen Miller, who's the other evil genius behind his policies like the caging of the children, right? So the second major process is when sociological stats go mainstream, as all of us are familiar with, right? We hear by 2042, 45, 50, the U.S. will be majority-minority. And these kinds of graphs and statistics, you know, become mainstream. So here in 2013, all of a sudden, right, after white babies outnumbered minority babies, look what happens, right? There are now more minority babies, okay? What has been the reaction to this? I'd like to call it a reactionary reaction. On the left here, you have people whose Twitter handles or their content in their posts is about white genocide, okay? We are going to no longer exist because of all these people of color, right? And why I have this here is because these are people that Trump retweeted multiple times, okay? And actually, all these people are banned from Twitter. Okay. The other reaction to kind of point out here is from our favorite resident white supremacist in Congress, Steve King, who, you know, quoting Wilders as pictured earlier, understands that culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. Okay. White genocide, a race war. So you guys know what this means, right? You know, you have to set the mood with candles and Sade and make as many mixed and non-white babies as you possibly can, okay? Resist, right? That's got to be one of the more fun ways. okay, I don't have time for jokes. Okay, so one of the other reactions that you see, and this is borne out by research, especially from political science, is the social psychological impact of this majority-minority shift, the stat, right? That even if you
give it to U.S. liberals and Democrats, they actually become more conservative in their policy positions and in their support for the Republican Party. That's how powerful it is, okay? I think we should have been studying this more. What are the implications of our own data, right? The third major process, the rise of the racist Tea Party, taxes and racial backlash. So I'm taking this phrase back from Deneen Borelli, to mean that this is backlash, especially against Obama. So just quickly, to remind you, the Tea Party was founded by David Koch and Stephen Colbert as a grandpa. No, I'm just kidding. This is Charles Koch. But don't you think it looks just like him? I think it looks like Stephen Colbert. And they basically started this in 1993, right? It was a sucky time to be a Republican, and they decided that they were going to bend Washington to their will by funding extravagantly and organizing anti-tax groups, okay? Joined by the forces of Philip Morris, the cigarette magnate, okay? Now, where racism comes in, interestingly, is that the University of Arkansas found that racism significantly predicted Tea Party membership in the South, not the North. Okay, so there is a regional divide here. And what's striking is it was namely old-fashioned racism, the stuff that you and I as sociologists jettisoned from the surveys because people weren't responding to that stuff, right? These Southerners were proudly saying, yes, blacks are lazy, they're untrustworthy, they're unintelligent, no problem. And that predicted Tea Party membership, okay? Now, this Tea Party membership tended to be younger, more female, and less educated, okay? So the statistics seem to constantly around 47%. We should not be surprised, actually, that 47% of white women voted for Trump, okay? Now, this is where the backlash comes in, both nationally and in the South. So basically across the country, the most significant predictor of Tea Party membership was disapproval of President Obama, okay, a black president, okay? Now, there was a study done trying to test Herbert Bloomer's group position theory of race prejudice. And what it tentatively found but would not, categorically say was that, they did their experiment with a controlled, in a controlled setting. They gave some people a lightened Obama. They gave some people a darkened Obama, right? Surprise, surprise, the darkened Obama predicted more racial animus, economic anxiety, and Tea Party support. Okay, it's not completely clear. But what's interesting is that when you study this in relation to Trump support, these authors have found solidly that it was race resentment that was animating economic anxiety that spurred Trump support. Okay, all right. Now, I think this is really fascinating, the way Obama's racialized. And I think looking at this through a nativist racist lens really helps. So I say that Obama experienced anti-Muslim, anti-Asian, and anti-Latinx racism because these groups tend to be seen as always associated with their parents' country or the country from which they might have originally immigrated, right? So, perfect example here. Where's Obama born? He's born in Kenya, Africa. The other common response you got was that he was born in Indonesia, right? And they make sure to throw in that his dad was born in Kenya, okay? So even though he's a black American man, born and raised in the United States, for the brunt of his life, he is racialized as a forever foreigner. Now, clearly the anti-Muslim reference here is clear, right? Obama, Osama, terrorist, right? I think they darkened his skin in this picture. The anti-Latinx nativist racism, I saw it in billboards like this. Where's the birth certificate, right? This is an actual billboard. And Donald Trump was one of the ringleaders, if you remember, of this birther movement, right? He was saying in 2011 that he was proud to be a birther, and he questioned the short, long-form, paper, digital birth certificate, right? That's not real, right? But here I think it's interesting because it's very redolent of this idea of this man illegally running for president and presenting false documents, right? I think that's a very kind of anti-Latinx racialization. Okay. Now, again, as we remember from Orlando Patterson's New York Times article, he really felt that the 3 a.m. phone call by Hillary Clinton was reminiscent of this kind of anti-Muslim, anti-black rhetoric, such as in Birth of a Nation. This is a picture that our campaign circulated to the Drudge Report. It's Obama respecting Somali elders in Kenya. This reminded me a lot of Natalia Molina's work, Racial Scripts. She's a historian, ethnic studies scholar. And what she says is that different racialized groups are linked across time and space. And she uses examples like the way Asian Americans, Latinos were kind of similarly racialized across historical epochs. She says that cultural representations are transferable from one group to another. Okay. And she says that these racial scripts are powerful and they have longevity. So just like we saw in the Obama example previous, you know, here's another one that a right-wing website had posted. The real Obama. He's an Indonesian Muslim socialist puppet. Okay? they're really shy here, you guys. You know, so this is a spiritual leader in Indonesia, right? And do you see that they literally consider him the same person, right? Splitting the screen as if they're one and the same. The fourth major process of nativist racism is the rise of nativist racist hate crimes and groups. This has not just happened since kind of Trump or the Tea Party has risen to prominence, but has been going on for a while, and especially since 9/11. Interestingly here, some of you may know, the very first person killed after the bombing of the World Trade Center was not an Arab Muslim, was not somebody we would associate, you know, with that group. It was an Asian American. This is a South Asian American man named Balbir Singh Sodhi. He is Sikh, right? And that's why he's wearing a turban. And he was landscaping his gas station in Mesa, Arizona, when a man named Frank Silva Roque shot him dead. And, you know, the day of the attacks, Frank Roque had said, I'm going to go out and shoot some towel heads. Okay. This is his daughter trying to carry on his legacy. Now, I want to start with anti-Muslim assaults, because if you look at what the Pew Research Center found, you see that, okay, definitely in 9/11, look at the spike in hate crimes against Muslims or people perceived to be Muslims, right? Like South Asian Americans. Now, you see here, you know, it's been pretty steady, and then it goes up in 2015, okay? This is when Trump is rising to prominence, right? By the end of 15, he has established his Muslim ban policy. In the following year, in 2016, there's almost a 70% jump in anti-Muslim crime, okay? Now, just to remind you, you know, his anti-Muslim public rhetoric began earlier in 2010 when he said the United States is at war with Muslims. Do you remember his comment that there were New Jersey Arabs that were cheering as the WTC came down? And again, the proposal on the campaign trail of the Muslim ban. Okay, now I'm sorry this graphic is terrible. I could not get it to work, but essentially this is from the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is about the incredible rise of hate group formation. So what you see here is in 1999, we had 457 hate groups, which is still a lot. Okay. By 2018, we have the highest in our history, which is 1,020 hate groups. Okay. One of the things we have to bear in mind here is that it's anti-Muslim groups that have added a lot of chapters. So, for example, this group called Act for America added 50 chapters. Michael Flynn is one of their board members. Okay. The hate group formation has also been spawned by online hate activity. There is a site called the Daily Stormer, which is a neo-Nazi site. I went on there and I couldn't even read it. It was so horrible. But essentially, a lot of hate group formation is being generated online. So a perfect example of that was how Dylann Roof was inspired by these websites. And these are the nine Black American worshipers that were murdered in cold blood by Roof in Charleston. Okay. What's also scary is that the Anti-Defamation League is actually finding that there's hero worship of Roof online. And in the last couple months, there have been copycat crimes and attempts to, you know, basically follow in his footsteps. Okay. So here is a graphic of U.S. hate crimes. It's really kind of pointing out the rise between 2015 and 2017, but I think what's also alarming is how steady it has been, right? One of the important things to know about this is that most of these crimes have actually been committed by far-right white nationalist extremists, not by Islamic extremists. And what the Anti-Defamation League has found is that these white racist nationalist networks seem to be larger and better armed than ever before. Okay. And so, you know, something that we definitely should be tracking, and trying to understand, okay? So I want to kind of revisit, you know, moving now to theoretical implications, I want to revisit this conceptualization of the color line and the citizenship line. And as much as I think this theory is very useful and provocative, you know, there are certain criticisms I have of it. You know, one of the major criticisms I elaborated on in my book, Imperial Citizens, which I did not think it dealt with the unit of the nation enough. It didn't deal with, transnational and global racial orders enough. And so that's what I wrote about. But one of the other things that I think is going on is that we need to be able to order the, racialized foreigner, un-American, American line. I don't think it's a horizontal axis always. So one of the ways that I've kind of thought about it is to think of it as a Venn diagram where we can look at, you know, an ordered superiority, inferiority, as well as an ordered national insider and outsider dimension, right? I mean, this is clearly what racist white nationalism in the Trump era is, right? And one of the things that I think this helps us do is that it helps us analyze racial scripting, such as done against Obama, right? Such as I think has been done against a lot of these groups and is the way that racism and nativist racism operates, right? Notice that in Claire Jean Kim's formulation, the lines don't cross, right? So to conclude, you know, and to think about sort of future research directions on the color and citizenship line, I would really encourage us to think about racial scripting and try to see how it's operated historically or what's going on in the present, right? One of the other conclusions that I come to is that I think it's interesting that Trump's white supremacy pivots on anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim refugee racism, right? And in some ways, he's kind of submerging anti-African-American discourse. But of course, he's practicing anti-black racism, right? He's just kind of toning down the discourse. And I think what's interesting is that the inverse was mostly true before the rise of Trump and white racist nationalism, is that the practice and the discourse was much more focused on anti-blackness, but there was racism going on against Latinos, for example. Okay. So, you know, these are some of the ways now that he's reappropriated, you know, discourse about blacks. Remember him saying, join us, what have you got to lose, right? The Democrats have made your lives miserable because you're all dying in the inner city, right? Join us, join me. He makes sure to parade his blacks for Trump, which is one guy and maybe a couple others. And, you know, parading around Kanye West and the Jim Brown Love Fest. He recently defended Candace Owens, right? The practice, however, is thoroughly anti-black, right? Trump and the DOJ's law and order crime policies are severely harming black Americans, right? He's gutting social services that black Americans have had to rely on because of centuries of oppression. Hate sites, groups, and crimes are thoroughly anti-black. The Trump administration, the DOJ is doing nothing, and they indirectly stoke this, right? And interestingly, the highest deportation spike, right, by ICE is against African immigrants, okay? So all this stuff is going on, but not, you know, being the focus of his attacks. So the final question I want to ask is, you know, where are we going? Well, if you ask Jason Kessler, who was the co-organizer of the 2017 Unite the Right rally, he says that we are fastly becoming a minority in the country we founded. Okay, and I think this is a haunting photograph. This is the night Heather Heyer died, right, was killed. I think, and I'm an optimist realist, and it pains me to say this, but if we don't deal with the acute sense of racial resentment, right, based on this kind of construction of relative deprivation, right, I really don't think we're going to make a dent in this movement. I think it's possible that he'll be reelected. I think it's possible that the movement will just grow and grow. I don't want to think that, but, you know, I do think it matters that, you know, we just haven't had, a thorough intellectual and academic response to that sense of racial resentment as it interacts with economic anxiety. And so what I would implore is, you know, hopefully we scholar activists can, you know, maximize our knowledge and our skills to make sure that, you know, there's not one more Marie or Felipe or Jacqueline or a Muad who dies in the name of Trump nativist racism. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Of our U.S. population has suffered due to colonization.
Yes.
Hispanics,
yes.
Asians, and a few African American immigrants.
Yeah.
So do you think we should also ask for some reparations? Because we are more than, I think our country suffered more colonization, I think more severely than slavery. So should we ask the queen or should we ask?
That is a great question. Well, it doesn't hurt to ask, right?
She was the one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, we could, you know, hey, like, you know, the Nazis were put on trial, you know, I mean, you know, I think what's interesting is that the reparations debate has actually come into the political discourse. I mean, I was kind of surprised and impressed by that because it's something that Black Americans and other people have been raising for decades and it's never gotten any traction. But I think because of the progressive move, you know, of the Democrats, which is thoroughly confusing the party, you know, reparations is on the table. To me, I can't help but think of how, though, bifurcated our society is and our politics are right now, right? I mean, you know, you now have such an emboldened racist far right, you know, in a Trump constituency for whom that would be fodder for hate crimes and, you know, assaults and sort of the discrediting, right, of Black anti-Black American racism, and now you have Candace Owens, a Black American woman, who's out there and is like, reparations are the stupidest, dumbest thing ever. You know, like, I was never a slave, right? So I've never experienced racism. You know, so you know, you have that, but then you have, you know, the other side who is like, you know, trying to put forth sophisticated, historical, colonially, imperialistically minded arguments about why reparations are absolutely necessary, right? And so, you know, I mean, I think that we should keep at it. I think that we should, if we can bring in the queen, right, and we can bring in colonizers, right, I think that actually is informative. That shapes and changes the discourse, right? It's not just about these individuals that are white and these individuals that are people of color now fighting with each other or he said, she said, but this is about look at the legacy of that, right, and how that explains inequalities today. I think that would be a valuable addition to our discourse on race. Would it happen? I don't know.
American taxpayers don't have much to do on it. I mean, Spain, Portugal, England, UK, Germany, all these were the ones who are the ones responsible for this mess.
They are, but if we want to have a discussion about privilege, it's people in the United States who've benefited from enslavement and indigenous genocide. Yes.
Some of the resources back.
Yes.
I mean, we could look at, like, there's been so many issues also invaded.
Yeah.
Captured. Mm-hmm. And media doesn't really talk about colonizers. This was slavery, I feel.
Yeah. And that's partly why I want sociology to talk about it more. I want that to be our framework and our paradigm, right? Because it's crucial, right? You know, but one of the other things that you're bringing up is the issue of taxes, right? And Americans hate taxes. Like, that's what the Kochs knew. If they just said the word taxes, right, they would get all kinds of followers, and they did. They germinated this huge political movement, right, that's in the vice president's office today, right? So, you know, I think we also then have to open up this conversation that I think Bernie Sanders and other, and AOC and other candidates are trying to have about, you know, the inherent inequity in the way taxes are paid, right? Amazon and Netflix, I mean, they don't have to pay they don't even pay a nickel, right? And look at the under-resourcing of all our public resources, right? So, yeah.
Wait, 1, 2, 3.
Okay, so I want to come back to Jen Richardson.
Yes.
So the social psychological research that she and many others now
is
unequivocal.
Mm-hmm.
Whites feel status threat, and they feel status threat because of their perceptions of the demographic and other changes that are taking place in the United States.
Most
and
definitely.
It causes many to respond in conservative ways.
And, yes.
And, you know, it drives the polarization, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
All the political scientists who studied the 2016 election say that, in effect, it was decided by the racial resentment of less well-off whites.
Yes.
We're social scientists.
So right.
These are facts now.
We
established them.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we address the sort of the zero-sum thinking that I would say not just whites have, but many social scientists have too, about how American society divided, cleaved between whites and people of color.
Yeah.
It's this model of the society that is really provoking, to some extent, to a large extent,
yes,
this reaction. So do you have some ideas about
that? That's a great question. You know, I can talk about it from my own kind of reevaluation of my own work, which is that, I've always been, highly sensitive to class inequality. I mean, I'm a neo-Marxist, but as a race scholar, I think what happened, and is still with us is that, because race scholars were reacting so much to kind of Marxist sociology, basically saying that race is an epiphenomenon of class, that I think we race scholars kind of overcompensated and went the other way, right? Which we have to prove that racism is an institutionalized formal structuration of its own. And, I think, what ends up happening is that we talked a lot about race and gender, and for obvious reasons, like our race and gender tends to be more visibly and more quickly received than our class location, right? But class really got lopped off. And, I think that instead of having these either or debates, which I think we do a lot in sociology, right? We do this either or thing. We fixate on gaps, but maybe what we could fixate on instead, like I was saying, what do we look at? What do we emphasize is the interrelationship between these axes, right? And even looking at historical or situational specificity, right? I mean, there's a lot of like contextual nuance that I think looking at the interrelationship would invite. And so, when I thought about my own work, I was realizing, instead of kind of overcompensating and going with the kind of intellectual tide, probably what would have been more effective is to really, select research questions and populations that would illuminate, right, the way in which neoliberal economics, globalization, capitalism is, co-causal, co-constitutive, co-concurrent with racial inequality, right, with race prejudice. So I think kind of in a bigger picture way, like that's one way we can start, I think the other thing, that we might want to do is think maybe we can pinpoint more the ways in which, those who are disadvantaged economically lose out when they are so fixated on race as the main line of division, right? The working class people of color have it just as bad, worse than the white working class, right? But if we were able to kind of show the commonalities, right, in the disadvantage over time with union decline, et cetera, right, loss of access to college education, I think that could be another way in which, hopefully we can get beyond, this just the race divide. But of course, remember, it's an uphill battle. The United States has always chosen to use race as the main line of division, right? And so this is, we're up against a major uphill battle. But that, I think we can still do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
About
yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Because now there is a commonly accepted saying that although it's not class issue that drives this kind of a racial, racist.
More conservatism, Trump Tea Party support, yeah.
Because it is neoliberalism that put everybody, especially the white working class or the middle class, in the very precarious condition that they started to, that grows their resentment. So I was wondering about your position in this kind of argument.
Yeah.
It's very prevalent in the leftist camp.
Yes,
but
yeah.
If you answer that one, maybe we'll take two because the hour is getting late.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Professor, I was wondering about your thoughts on this entering class of freshman representatives in the House.
Yeah.
How many of them embody along many dimensions the very things that live rent-free in, like, the racist right-wing head.
Yes.
You're a woman, you're brown, you're not Christian, you're this and that.
You're Muslim.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, given that, and how any one of their missteps will be amplified, just like a woman of color at work. Like,
yes.
She makes the misstep as
yes.
a person's experience is amplified, you know. So how do you think about that in terms of, you know, how the right is not just, you know, seizing on these things, but using it to, you know, frankly, promote more hatred and even, you could argue, incitement to violence even today against Ilhan Omar and so forth.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good question. Yeah, thanks. Did you want to pick one more? Okay. So, okay, thank you for your question. You know, I think one of the ways that I see it, and it is a very complicated issue, and, you know, you're right. Maybe it's not as neat and clean as it's come out in the studies thus far. I mean, though it could definitely lean in those directions, right? But that's why I think we should continue to study this. You know, one of the issues that... let's say lower status whites. I'm not going to say the poorest whites because it wasn't, but lower status whites, felt an acute sense of relative deprivation was the fact that they couldn't afford college for their children. Okay. And the fact that they did not believe that their children were going to even get to their level of income or economic stability, let alone leapfrog them. Right. So, you know, to me, like this notion of the unaffordability of college, like the fact that college is now more and more for the elite and the privileged. And my goodness, this recent college admission scandal, if that doesn't elucidate that more, then I don't know what does. Right. But, you know, I think that's an interesting case in which maybe it's not so neat and clean that racial resentment animated economic anxiety, which then predicts Tea Party or Trump support, right? You know, I think we have to seriously consider, you know, the way in which neoliberalism has meant the under-resourcing, the underfunding, and the out-of-reach status of so many things now that are so important. Remember that slide about how much a college degree gave you in terms of income, in terms of, you know, stability in the higher class strata? You know, that's not lost on these folks, you know? And so, you know, in some ways, like, you know, maybe it would require the mixing of qualitative and quantitative methodologies, but I think we really have to look at the complicated relationship between class and race. And maybe we don't even think of it as class and race, but we think of it as a third space. It's a fusion, right? That becomes a new thing, right? Because I think it's hard sometimes to separate out, right? And, you know, maybe that's sort of our disciplinary tenets that make us do that. And so maybe we should resist that impulse, okay? So to answer your question about, yeah, this freshman class of women, you know, I think... It's obviously very unfortunate, the Islamophobic and the death threats against Ilhan Omar, you know, the way in which, in very sexist and sexualized ways, they've discredited AOC. You know, they definitely want to trumpet her socialist, you know, credentials the way they want to do Bernie. Because what does that mean? That means more taxes, taxation, right? Like, oh, you know, the boogeyman. You know, but I think what's also very hopeful about it in a really backwards way is that they are absolutely threatened by this freshman class of congresswomen. Because if you think about the way in which the white nationalist Tea Party Trump came to power, it's all premised on fear. As Barry Glassner would call it, the culture of fear, right? Or anxiety, right? Which is, you know, these immigrants are coming. They're going to take over, these Muslims. They're going to take over. They're going to kill you, right? And I think the issue of white genocide and the race war, what is that premised on? That's premised on fear and anxiety that whites will no longer exist, right? We are going to lose the country we founded, right? And so I think the more they react, the more they attack, as horrible and as hate crime spawning as that could be, I actually think it's indicative of how threatened they actually feel by this pushback and these counter movements. And so, you know, there's a silver lining, right, to most things. And so, you know, I think hopefully if we can build movements around AOC, Ilhan Omar, as has been going on, you know, like I actually think, you know, to be more, you know, salutary, I want to think about the ways in which this has promoted a great deal of politicization and, you know, political movements on the other side, on the left, right? And we've moved in a more progressive direction that I think, you know, there's hope there for sure.
Well, I think if people want to talk to Nadia about and you want about some of these issues, they can just approach her in the reception.
Okay, thank you, Nancy. Yeah, I appreciate it.